This is Mae Warren. Today is the 14th of September, 1999. I'm at the Peabody Archives with Elizabeth Schaff. And Elizabeth, you know that I'm here because you are the early history of the Peabody. And you know it better than anybody. But I'd like to start by talking about your history and what first brought you to the Peabody, and when and how you got here.
Well, I came to Peabody in 1965, and I wanted to come here as a student, and my options were to get a job and pay my own way, and so the logical thing to do was to get a job at Peabody, which meant that I was right in place, and it worked out very well. I worked here in a number of capacities over the years, and took classes and studied voice and minored in early instruments. And it couldn't have been handier. If I needed to go to class, I just said, excuse me, and ran down the hall or up the steps or down the steps as need be. And I got to see the institution in two different ways, and it was, you know, as a student and as a member of staff. So it was an interesting process. The conservatory was going through an interesting period, and some of it good and some of it not so good.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, Peabody was really sort of heading for the ropes. Was having terrible financial problems. That would be a decade. It would be about a decade before things got sorted out, or at least headed in a more positive direction. There was also an upheaval on the administrative side. Charles Kent was director when I came to Peabody. And he had been dean under Peter Menon, his predecessor. Menon, who was a composer who went on to become head of the Juilliard School, had brought him in as dean. He was a fabulous teacher, a born teacher. He himself was a composer. He was interested in contemporary music and electronic music. He was brilliant acoustician, and taught acoustics. Very sympathetic man, and very much in touch with the students. And it was a good time. The director's office was then in the conservatory building, in what was initially envisioned as the Maryland Historical Society rooms, and. The upshot of this meant that, you know, the director had to walk down the hall to go to the men's room, and so, you know, he couldn't avoid talking to the faculty and talking to the students, and there was no cafeteria that, if you needed a Coke or, you know, you had to walk upstairs to this little sort of informal lunchroom on the third floor, and so there was a lot of give and take among the students. It, you know, the director wasn't a remote figure. You know, it was somebody that you had in class and somebody that that you ran into in the hallway. And this would change in later years. And then, you know, most recently it's changed back. And the director is again walking down the hall to the men's room and teaching and. Being more approachable to the students and to the faculty, and which is it's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. And so you studied voice
mm-hmm.
here?
Yeah.
Were there any faculty who made a difference to you? Anybody in particular who was very special for you?
Well, you know, it was there were a lot of remarkable people on the faculty, and one of the nice things about working at Peabody while I was going to school is that I had contact with people that, you know, that I, as a student, probably wouldn't have. And so You know, I got to talk to other voice teachers about how they approached different, you know, problems, and there were a lot of wonderful people here. I mean, there was Flor Vent, who was a fabulous soprano. She was a Swiss-born Parisian, who was a wonderful technician, just authority on French vocal literature. Frank Valentino, who was, you know, a former member of the Metropolitan Opera, who just, you know, lovely, amiable man, and Wayne Connor, who's still on the faculty today, and Alice Gerstel-Duchock, with whom I studied, who, you know, was a transplanted Viennese. And there were people like Stefan Grove, who was just who taught theory and composition. And, I, you know, I still have my notes on his Baroque ornamentation classes. I mean, he's just a fabulous teacher.
Why was he so fabulous?
Well, he was a brilliant man and a brilliant theoretician, terrifying to study with. I mean, he had very high standards. And I mean, Paula Hatcher tells this wonderful story about a theory examination that was just so incredibly difficult that only two people passed it. She was one of them, and Ray Sprinkle was the other. You know, and both are now on our faculty. The student body split down the middle. I mean, there were those who felt very confident and you know, respected his teaching and had the guts to take his courses. And then, you know, there were the other halves who were, you know, the other half that was concerned with making sure their grades were good and took theory with the amiable Dr. Cheslock, who was a very sweet and sympathetic soul, whose classes were considerably less challenging. And Sam de Bonaventura, who you know, taught music history and who was an authority on Marx Brothers films and made the best spaghetti sauce I'd ever had. And but it was a really interesting collection of people. And, you know, Britt Johnson, who was most of the principal members of the principal soloists in the Baltimore Symphony, were on the faculty. You know, there it was a stunning group of musicians. And as weak as Peabody was in those days, you know, the director was having serious health problems, and the place was being operated on a shoestring, but there were all of these, you know, wonderful people on the faculty, and as Bob Pierce put it, you know, very recently, I mean, Peabody's strength in those days was most definitely its faculty.
I've heard that the building was in great disrepair at that point too.
It actually, during those days, I mean, there certainly were problems. I mean, I remember they were, you know, during the dress rehearsal of Carmina Burana, when a fire broke out backstage because of the fault, you know, bad wiring. But, you know, Peabody had its own housekeeping staff, and during the summer, you know, everything was freshly painted and spiffed up and polished, and so when you came back in the fall, it looked like $1 million. And even though I'm sure that you know, it was like an aged lady with a fresh coat of makeup. But it looked good. Well, sadly, the problems occurred after the Hopkins affiliation.
Oh, do tell.
Well, because the housekeeping staff was let go, and they had a, you know, contract service come in to, you know, do the housekeeping. And it, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the nice lady who took care of Shapiro House and the other nice lady who took care of the conservatory building. And
oh, that, you know, must be what I'm hearing, yeah. What I've heard about.
Oh, it was just awful. And then, you know, they were all, I'm sure, just, you know, paid minimum wage. And, you know, I think half the maintenance staff had, you know, some sort of physical infirmity. But but somehow managed to keep the place looking good and keep it working. But one of the early cost-saving measures was, the transition over to contract maintenance, which immediately had made the entire place look terribly shabby after about a year. Mm. It was implications for morale, as you can well imagine, but that's a small thing.
Well,
it is and it isn't.
I'm trying to decide which direction we should go. Should we go back to the beginning and work our way up to the affiliation with Hopkins? Mm-hmm. It's probably a good idea to begin at the beginning.
All right.
So we have a bit of an idea of how Elizabeth got here. Let's find out how the Peabody got here.
Well, like all of Peabody's endeavors, Peabody was a place without a precedent. Peabody wasn't interested in...
When you say Peabody's
George
endeavors,
Peabody.
You're saying the man, George Peabody.
Yeah. George Peabody's whole approach to... He basically handled his philanthropies like he handled his business. He was constantly looking out for new ways of doing things, better ways of doing things. And he was not a conventional person by any means. And he sought good advice from highly competent people. And listened to them. He took their advice, and he did the same thing when he started building up his, creating the institutions that he supported, and he consulted a number of his former colleagues in Baltimore. Excuse me, I'm going to have to see.
Okay,
who that
just
is.
A moment.
Hook you.
Okay.
So anyway, when it came time for the Baltimore benefaction, Peabody had stayed. You knew he moved to London permanently in the year Queen Victoria ascended the throne and basically lived there the rest of his life. But he stayed in close contact with his friends here. And he had lived in Baltimore just about all of his adult life until he left to go to Britain. And he was in touch with people like John Pendleton Kennedy, Charles James Madison Eaton, Riggs, Tiffany, who was involved in raising money for the Maryland Historical Society, and some of them were business people, and some of them were people who were very much involved in the cultural life of the city. Kennedy was very interested in things literary, and he was himself, in addition to a legislator, a best-selling author, and one of the first to use American themes in his writing. Eaton was was similarly interested in the visual arts, and sponsoring American painters and developing, American talent. And Peabody himself was, very interested in music. He had boxes to the opera and Royal Albert Hall and enjoyed going to concerts. So when they started talking about what he could do for Baltimore, they tried to get him to rescue the Library Company of Baltimore, and Peabody wasn't interested in rescuing anything or shoring up some faltering institution. He was really interested in new ways of coping with problems, and Baltimore's problem at that point was its cultural wants. There was no public library. There was no resident orchestra, no resident professional orchestra, at least. There were theater orchestras and the like. There was no gallery of art. There was no you know, place where people could come and exchange ideas. And so he ended up founding the Peabody Institute, which was the country's first cultural center, and which in one broad swipe gave the city an orchestra, the Scholars Library, which was a public library, the Gallery of Art, and the Academy of Music. And the Institute did exactly what Peabody wanted an institution that would create a cultural revolution in Baltimore. And it did. Out of the Peabody Library made it possible for the Johns Hopkins University to get itself up and running and attract a respectable group of scholars to Baltimore, because it had a research library, which the young university obviously wasn't in a position to create out of whole cloth. Peabody men founded the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, Baltimore Opera, and even today, Baltimore Choral Arts, the Ragtime Ensemble, the number of Baltimore Chamber Orchestra, if you look around, it's staggering, the number of institutions that have grown out of this place, fundraising events to establish the Baltimore Museum of Art were held here at Peabody. And Peabody trustees were involved in the creation of that institution. William and Henry Walters were both chairmen of the Gallery of Art committees here at Peabody. It did just exactly what Peabody wanted.
And he selected an interesting group of trustees to mm-hmm. make this happen.
Right.
Tell me about that. I just know that much. I mean, I'm really not feigning ignorance here. I really don't know.
Well, he put together this large list of men that he knew, and men who were recommended by men that he trusted to draw the board from. And it was a list, I think, that he called of Baltimore's most respected citizens. And and it was, you know, men like Severin Teagle Wallace, Riggs, with whom he was a partner. It was quite an impressive list. And it was from that list that, and from their descendants, that future members of the board were drawn.
And one of the things you told me about the other day that I was here back in February, you got me excited telling me about this early relationship between the university and the Peabody, and how the Peabody really seemed to almost appreciate what the university would be more than the university did, or
well,
something to that effect.
When the university was founded, and there were overlapping trustees again, as there were with many of the other major institutions in town, the first thing the trustees did was pass a resolution that the two institutions should be affiliated at the earliest possible time. And that affiliation ultimately did take place exactly 100 years later. But this is Baltimore, things move slowly. But there really was a very close association between the two institutions from the very beginning. It was a given that if you were looking for a Hopkins faculty member, you walked down the Peabody Library and you found them there. The Herbert Baxter Adams, vaunted historical studies seminary, functioned here at Peabody, not at Hopkins.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it had rooms here. The Peabody collection was developed with the needs of Hopkins clearly in mind. The letters to the librarian are full of letters from faculty and also from the librarian at Hopkins saying, there's this wonderful series of books, or there's a wonderful book out. We don't have the budget to buy this. would you consider adding this to your collection? And it usually ended up in the collection. And so, you know, the Hopkins Library Collection and the Peabody Collection kind of grew in tandem. And then when you work in the Peabody Library, you can work right up to the time Hopkins Library moved up to the present campus. And when you get to that point, then you need to get on the shuttle and go up to Hopkins, and you can continue your research. But you know, the two libraries very much enhance one another, and that's the reason why, because of the number of Hopkins students and Hopkins faculty working here. They use the collection of casts of antiquities for classwork. I mean, the students observed, used to send their students up to the Peabody Gallery of Art to study the casts. There was the lecture series. There was a lecture series of scholarly lectures. There were many Hopkins people took part in that. There were people invited from other, Harvard, Yale, there was a scientific lecture series. Any of the 19th century scientists who were anybody were invited to participate. And the lecture series was formulated in cooperation with Hopkins, who had a similar series. When the scientific lecture series was eliminated, all of the scientific apparatus was turned over to Johns Hopkins University. And also when the preparatory department got itself up and running and was outgrowing its initial space, by that time Hopkins had moved up to the present campus, and the Peabody Preparatory functioned in the rooms of the former Johns Hopkins University buildings. So there's always been this kind of gentlemanly give and take between the two institutions. And Peabody Orchestra played for Hopkins graduations and functions. And Sidney Lanier, who was a member of the Peabody Orchestra when it was the city's first professional orchestra. It was one of only five in the country. Sidney Lanier came to Baltimore to be, he was first a musician and second a poet, in his own words. And he was hired here by Asger Hamrick, who was director of the conservatory and conductor of the orchestra, as first flutist. And of course he fell passionately in love with the library and had ample opportunity to write when he wasn't acquitting himself of his obligations to the orchestra. And then later on, he lectured on the Peabody lecture series, and then was later hired as a faculty member at Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Now, did it work the other way around? Did Peabody students take classes at Hopkins?
The first exchanges, I think, took place in around 1917, and the Peabody Summer School was a joint venture.
Tell me about that.
They were able to take classes at Hopkins and at Peabody, and the Hopkins students and Peabody people. That was the first summer school that Peabody had held, and it was a joint venture between the two institutions.
Do you know much about that? What kind of classes they offered?
I did at one time. I haven't looked at the course offerings in some long time. But it wasn't long after that it was possible for Peabody people to take courses for credit at Johns Hopkins. The affiliation of the 1970s really had much in the way of precedent.
Now, I know that the original Hopkins campus was very close by.
Right.
Can you describe that geographical proximity?
It was just over by Howard, and I think there's still an existing building over there. So it was quite literally down the street, and intentionally so they would have easy access to the Peabody Library.
How did the Peabody choose Mount Vernon Place? How did that selection originally happen?
A wrangle between the trustees, and Peabody had to come over and basically settle it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They had proposals for, there were offers of property all over the city. And there was quite a fuss, because here is this very large, very important institution getting ready to create itself within the confines of the city, and it would definitely have an impact on the surrounding property. And so, you know, people who were speculating in property offered patches of property where they owned additional land. The area across the street from the Basilica, where the library is now located, was a possibility. There was an area out by the reservoir, which was a larger tract of land, which would have been closer to where the present university is located. That was another possibility. That was Kennedy's option. He wanted plenty of room for the institution because it was going to be a growing entity. And he wanted to have it provided with plenty of room to grow. Eaton, on the other hand, wanted to keep it downtown. He wanted it near Maryland Historical Society, he was very much involved with the Historical Society. Wanted it to be city oriented, and this was out of town. I mean, it was Howard's Woods, and overlooking the bulk of the city. I mean, granted, there were lovely buildings already in this area. This was a kind of middle ground. It was out of town. You know, you could still buy property here. I mean, the original building is on the site of an old marble yard. So this was a compromise. It wasn't a sole choice.
So did they just use that marble to build the building?
No, it's Baltimore County. Well, it was a marble yard. It wasn't a quarry.
So describe the structure here for me.
Initially, it was, there were these four major divisions, and to be headed by a provost who also was librarian of the George Peabody Library. Which worked out just fine for a while. By virtue of his position, he was sort of the grand poobah of intellectual affairs in the city, and often quoted in the paper, and sort of used as a local oracle on various subjects. And the conservatory, which was slower to get off the ground, was with its third director. James Monroe Deems, who was a Civil War hero, was the first director. And he basically got the Academy of Music going with its public offerings. He led an orchestra and got musical activities underway here. Southard was the one who started working on the educational part, the training of professional musicians. But Southard never really, I mean, he had wonderful pronouncements about how he was going to make it like the Paris Conservatory, and how he was going to make it like, all of these grand European conservatories. And it just wasn't getting off the ground. And it wasn't until they brought Asger Hamrick in, who was a Dane, who was a protege of Hans von Bülow, to take it over, that the place took off. And he wanted to make it a peculiar kind of American conservatory, one that would be provide a forum for American artists. He was a composer. He championed the performance of new works, encouraged other composers to find American themes to incorporate into their music. Did get the orchestra up and running, made it an orchestra of national stature, and all of a sudden, he was getting more press and in competition with the provost, which quite naturally led to some friction between the two. The provost considered the library as the centerpiece of the institute, and the conservatory was actually quartered in a row house up on Mulberry Street. It wasn't even located here. And they were grudgingly allowed to use what the provost called the lecture hall, which is the now Freeburg Concert Hall, for their concerts. But only grudgingly. And, you know, Morrison thought it was even inappropriate to have rehearsals in the lecture hall, and sort of demeaning. So the upstart conservatory really was quite a thorn in Morrison's side.
So when did the conservatory move to this location?
Well, it kind of insinuated itself gradually over the years. It was almost the turn of the century when it had really gotten itself. And it continued to encroach, because the Gallery of Art was a major. When the people don't realize that when that second building was built, you know, the conservatory was, I mean, the Peabody Institute building was done in two stages, and as a cost-saving measure, the building, what we call the 1857 building, which housed the lecture room, as Provost Morrison styled it, and then overhead was the library. And then the building that went up in the 1870s provided the library, the burgeoning library, with this grand room that we know today. And the second floor, the whole great second floor of the conservatory building, what we now call the conservatory building, was devoted to the Gallery of Art. There was no provision for conservatory quarters on that floor. The third floor had a few small rooms partitioned off for the conservatory, for music rooms. But over the years, you know, the fact that the art gallery was supposed to be funded by Tennessee bonds, which Tennessee was the only state that never redeemed its defaulted bonds, meant that the growth of the Gallery of Art suffered as a result. And the conservatory, as the gallery was limping along, the conservatory was booming under Hamrick and growing by leaps and bounds, and gradually taking over the rooms that had been appointed for the Gallery of Art.
Now, you mentioned the library, the room. We should describe that. We should just assume I have never walked into that room, and prepare me to walk into that room. Tell me what I'm going to see.
Well, the trustees wanted a building that would be safe. There had been a number of fires in the city. We hadn't even had the big one yet, you know. But fire safety was a great concern, and they had this French salesman come in who was selling this revolutionary building material called teal. And
teal?
Teal. There's a chunk of it sitting in the next room. It was imported from France. It was a 19th century building material, very new. Backing up a little bit, the building itself was as forward-looking as the institution was. It really reflected very well the kind of institution Peabody had in mind. When you go into the hall, you realize that apart from the back, where the small balcony is located in the back, there are no pillars in that room. It was one of the largest unpillared halls of its time, and it was made possible by using bridge construction in the ceiling. And a very clever Edmund G. Lind, who was the architect, English-born architect, who was also a musician, by the way, and wrote a marvelous paper on synesthesia. You know, that's people who synesthesia is a phenomenon where people hear colors and hear music and associate colors with the particular tones. So he created this fabulous room using this bridge construction. When they built the library building, which is the one you were asking about, Lynn used bridge construction again, but this time a new metal bridge type construction that allowed him to create this marvelous room with tiers of stacks overhead. And so there's this wonderful, it's a wonderful lofty room. I mean, you can just sort of feel your spirits rise up when you walk in there and see the you know, all of the beautiful cast iron and so they use this teal material in the walls and in the building so that there wouldn't be a fire hazard. The cast iron was a concern because, you know, in a fire the cast iron will melt. So the supporting girders, you can't see. What you see when you go in there are the beautiful decorative exterior girders. And they're the only wood in the room is actually the shelving that the library books are packed on. And books, actually, when they're packed up like that, don't really burn very well. So they'd pretty well done their job. And but it was the end result was this stunning, stunning room.
It certainly was. It certainly is. I'll always remember the first time I ever walked in there as a child, just being having my breath taken away.
It is. It's quite wonderful.
And the staircase. Tell me about the staircase. I don't know.
Well, the spiral staircase. The ironwork was all that beautiful cast ironwork was all made here in town by Hayward Bartlett, and as was the decorative ironwork in the Peabody Library. And if you look at the decorative motifs in the balconies that encircle the room, you can see them echoed in some of the Hayward Bartlett roof crests on some of the buildings in town. Mount Royal Terrace has a roof, you know, one of those beautiful cast iron roof crests that has that same pattern that you see in the Peabody Library.
So you must have a lot of fun as you go around and see the relationships between this place and the city where it's set.
Yeah, I suppose so. I get, you know, I just consider it part of the fabric of the city, so it's a sort of seamless entity. But, you know, the Baltimore County marble matching the monument. And, oh, they sent a delegation of trustees over to Washington to look at the buildings in Washington to pick out what kind of marble to use. And they ended up, you know, deciding that the Baltimore County marble was the most suitable finish for the building. But the most interesting thing about the building was the fact that it was, in the words of the trustees to the architects who were competing for the job, they asked for a building that would be capable of harmonious adjustment, because they knew as the building that the institution would change over the years, and the building had to be able to change with it. And which I suppose probably gives preservationists a bit of a pause, because, you know, what do you do with a building that was conceived as a sort of changing entity over the years? And, well, I guess just what we did with it, you know, it's grown with us, and we have this fabulous 19th century building, and inside of it we have a state-of-the-art electronic music facility, wonderful recording facilities with, you know, the latest digital equipment, and yet, you know, these wonderful, wonderful spaces, you know, with a beautiful 19th century design.
Do Yeah, it really is a very special place.
Well, you hear people talking about, you know, how conservative Peabody is, and you know, tradition bound, and it is in many ways. But you know, its tradition from the very beginning has been to look forward, and it has been in very many ways, a futuristic place. It's always been a place, in the best of times, it's been a place to try new ideas and to explore new ways of doing things. The conservatory had the first scientific studio for examining music as a, the scientific side of music. And that was back in the early 30s, and that studio was run in conjunction with Hopkins Engineering and Hopkins Medical Institutions.
Really? Yeah. I don't know anything about that.
Oh, yeah. And I think there's a photograph in here, Otto Ortmann, who established that. Ortmann would later become director of the Institute, a fine scholar. His book on the physical aspects of piano performance is still the leading work on the subject.
While you look for that, I'm going to turn the tape over.
Okay.
Let's talk about major events in the history of Peabody, and we've sort of glossed right over the first major event, the dedication. We have that glorious photograph. Mm-hmm. Tell me what happened that day. Tell me what you know about it.
Oh, goodness. Well, they had a... It was a series of things. I mean, there were, you know, some festive dinners. The hundreds and hundreds of school children paraded in front of the Institute, and there were concerts and speeches and... And it was a time of reconciliation. The Civil War was over. Our trustees were divided. I mean, we had people like Severin Teagle Wallace who got arrested in the middle of the night and taken down to Fort Warren, and was a Southern sympathizer. And we had men like Johns Hopkins. Edith Pratt, who was selling horseshoes to the Union Army. So it was the first time many of the trustees had spoken to one another, since the outbreak of hostilities. And and Peabody, too, had been under a lot of criticism. He maintained his friendships with people who had allied themselves with the South. Peabody himself, was New England born, and worked very hard to keep the Union together in London, and because there was a great effort to swing London around, Britain around to the back, the South, and after the war, when the South was just practically, well, it was in ruins, he created the Southern Education Fund, which provided the basis for public school education in the South. He was, one of his dearest friends was Corcoran, who was, Southern in his leanings. And Peabody kept his friends, continued cordial relations with them, and was solidly criticized for it. Even though he made very sure that none of his business dealings aided the South, he wouldn't involve himself in businesses that were likely to provide an advantage for the South, and was most definitely pro-Union, but was still subject to some fairly harsh criticism. And so when he talked to, when he gave his talk to the hosts assembled for the dedication, he used it as a kind of reconciliation and also to explain why he didn't feel that he should disassociate himself from his friends. And so it was a very emotional time, and a time of great excitement too.
So he actually came for the dedication.
He was here for the dedication, stood on the front steps welcoming the all the dignitaries, and kissed all the girls that or as many of them as he possibly could, and the school girls who marched past. He had a deep and abiding appreciation for attractive women, even though he was really bad at getting himself settled down.
Well, I guess in a way, thank goodness.
Like Hopkins.
It probably wouldn't be here.
Right.
If these fellows had been luckier in love.
Right.
How about his relationship with Johns Hopkins, the person? Do you know anything about
that?
Well,
he was credited with John Wirt Garrett, and several of his cronies were desperate to get Hopkins to come to grip with his fortune, and were trying to get him to settle on a major benefaction, and hadn't been able to pin him down. I mean, Hopkins was used to being pursued for various endeavors. There was a letter in the archives from our provost before he came, Philip Euler, who was a naturalist before he came to Baltimore, who tried to get Hopkins involved in setting up a museum of natural history in Baltimore. And he managed to brush Euler off in fairly easy strokes and sent him on his way. But Peabody was loath to tell anybody how to spend their money, and he figured that was a very personal decision, and that's not something that he should really do. But he agreed to come to dinner at the Garrett Mansion to talk to Hopkins about his own benefactions, and he told Hopkins about the Peabody homes and what they meant to the poor of London, and told him, I think he chided Hopkins about the fact that he was the only person who enjoyed making money and holding on to it more than he did. And he said, and explained to him that the only thing that had given him greater pleasure was the benefactions that he had created over the years, in his later years. But I should point out here two things. One, Peabody is forever being described as this, saintly person who spent no money on himself, who lived in rented rooms, and was a parsimonious fellow. I mean, absolutely nothing could be farther from the truth. You know, he spent money on clothing. He loved making sure that he was turned out in a fairly grand style. You know, he lived in rented rooms because he had enough people to manage in his business. And, since he didn't have a wife as an unpaid manager of his home, I mean, he just couldn't deal with all of that. And so his rented rooms were hardly dismal surroundings. I mean, he managed to place himself in very comfortable circumstances. And he spent more money on his salmon fishing vacations than probably most people during that time would earn in several lifetimes, and had his own very fancy carriage, and his boxes at the opera and at Royal Albert Hall, and he loved entertainment, and hardly spent his whole waking hours working. I mean, he did keep banker's hours indeed in the traditional sense, and was usually at dinner with friends by 7 in the evening, and he enjoyed his life very much, and enjoyed the company of enjoyed congenial company and a beautifully set table. And his benefactions weren't new. I mean, he was giving money to various charities when he was a young business person here in Baltimore, And there was a tradition of philanthropy in Baltimore, even when in the early years here in the 19th century. And this was not something that visited him late in life when he decided that he needed to reconcile himself with his maker. Hmm. But Hopkins did, in fact, after that dinner, do his will creating that made possible the creation of the university and the hospital.
Now, you say that dinner took place at Garrett's house. Yes. Would that have been Evergreen?
I think it was. You know, I'm not sure, but I thought it was downtown.
Oh, okay. That would have been completing the circle if it had been Evergreen. But we won't jump to that conclusion. So, fill me in, what other major events should I be looking for in Peabody history?
Goodness, major events. How do you deal with that? Is a major event, finding a marvelous talent like John Charles Thomas, who was the most popular singer in the country and went from being a star on Broadway to a star at the Metropolitan Opera and enjoyed a fabulous career on radio. Finding somebody like James Morris, who is the most sought after name in the world of Wagnerian opera today. My goodness. Or hosting a fantastic performance of the orchestra that makes you wonder how in the world young people could play like that. I mean, it's, how do you define a grand and wonderful event? It's taken, it's so taken for granted here. You could almost on any day of the week in the springtime walk into Griswold Hall, Leakin Hall, Concert Hall, and hear a performance of such quality and so impressive that you can't, it's just mind-boggling. We've all gotten very complacent about it. And we've had wonderful, wonderful people here over the years and, fabulous members of the fabulous faculty and visiting artists. I mean, it's hard to think of a time when something incredible wasn't going on.
Well, now that puts things in perspective for me. Well, then let's leap ahead to the one that is most apropos for my assignment in talking about the affiliation with Hopkins and how that came to be.
Well, it was one of these situations born out of necessity. Stephen Muller was the person who spearheaded the effort. Peabody had gone public with its plight. We had kept the wolves at the back door instead of the front door, and Richard Goldman finally decided that it was time to let people know how desperate the situation was, and went public. And then Peabody was approached by Hopkins, with the idea of an affiliation. And I think Provost Wolfe was very much involved in those early discussions. He was a very gentlemanly and amiable man who probably contributed a lot to that process. But it was definitely strong influence of Stephen Muller that made that affiliation happen. And it was a very good thing for the institution. And I can't think of another institution that would have made that affiliation as gracefully as Hopkins. And I was few years ago, the Peabody College in Nashville, Tennessee, affiliated with Vanderbilt. And I was surprised when I went down there how much, things were still seemed raw and uncomfortable. There was a bit of a friction between the two institutions. And clearly, the Peabody needed rescuing there every bit as much as Peabody here needed rescuing. But I think Hopkins, with its wonderful decentralized diadem of institutions, made that affiliation possible in a much more graceful way than its southern counterpart. And, I'm always struck by, you know, the fact that Vanderbilt and Peabody were good friends, and, you know, these two institutions have, both affiliated with Peabody benefactions. Appropriate of nothing here we're talking about. as with any event of that sort, I mean, there are bound to be a lot of frayed nerves and apprehensions about the future. Here was a large institution up the road from us trying to figure out how a conservatory functioned, and, you know, what do you mean there's only one teacher for one student? You know, we've got lots more up there, you know, and it's cheaper. They had to learn how a conservatory of music functioned, and quickly, you know, they were a quick study and respected what was going on here, they saw the strengths of the institution and were in a very good position to do something about the weaknesses of the institution, and it's been a wonderful fit. As far as the archives is concerned, was delighted to have, people like Nancy McCall at Hopkins Medical Institution's archives to go to for advice and counsel, and people like Jack Green and, you'll have to help me. I took, I don't know how many classes with him, and I can't, his name has just totally gone out of my head.
You have to give me a clue.
Member of the Hopkins History faculty.
What's his specialty?
Radical politics, race relations.
Franklin Knight? No.
Nope, no. Utopian societies. I was just thinking of the classes that I've taken with him over the years. Oh, he's a fabulous teacher. Just fabulous. How embarrassing.
It will come to you.
It will come to me. I'm sorry.
That's all right. It'll come.
And John Higham, who writes like God. And, you know.
So this is the opportunity you have to take classes.
Well, not only classes, but being able to go up and talk to them about the importance of the institution, the importance of the records that I was working with, and to, you know, to get a wider perspective on this institution's place in history as a, you know, the broader picture of the times, whatever time it was I was concerned with. Mm-hmm. And it was just wonderful, you know, having this incredible pool of talent this very deep well to draw from. And it was so wonderful to find out how generous they were with their time and with their counsel, and they were just terrific. And I know it helped me immensely in building up the archival collection here, and it helped me understand what it was I was charged with doing, and they were just terrific, and it was also wonderful to see them step in to shore up the library and you know, get good and competent people staffing the library. And I mean, there, you know, there had been fabulous people there in the past, and you know, much needed to be done. And so I think, you know, as a, on the whole, it was a, you know, it's been a very happy affiliation, and it's been very good for Peabody.
Tell me about Stephen Muller as a person. What, how did he come in here as a human being and make this proposal?
Well, I mean, obviously, I was privy to only some of that, and you know, there are probably much better many other people who could respond to this. Actually, a lot of them are dead already, come to think of it. Hell, it's a frightening thought. And it seems like such a short time ago, but I guess it's not already. Well, you know, President Mueller has, you know, he's a very forceful person, and, you know, seemed to me to be a real visionary. And, you know, had, from my limited perspective, he seemed to me a person who seemed to be able to look beyond initial impediments and initial problems to see where things were going. And and I think he saw the benefits, you know, the common ground that the two institutions shared, and which I think few people were aware of. And saw where the institution could go with Hopkins' help, and good heavens, it certainly did go. But in the years after the affiliation, I mean, the faculty was shored up. We had after the affiliation, there were some very shaky years when the administration was quite weak, and having Hopkins there to shore that up was a tremendous help. And but it's just been amazing to see the transformation in this institution since the 1970s when that affiliation took place. And you know, I can't imagine It would have been, I think, a very hard thing for most people to have shared that vision. I mean, because everybody was looking at Peabody as this hopelessly encumbered institution with a terrible burden of debt, you know, unable to, I mean, with few dreams flying around, let alone the money to make them happen. And The transformation has been, I mean, all you have to do is just look at the campus to see how the whole block has been transformed, and the whole institution has really come into its own. And I mean, Bob Pierce came in as the a successor to Elliot Galkin, and managed to pull the faculty back together again, and he's this wonderfully dignified, soft-spoken man who is probably, I mean, after working with him, I could see why he was the head of the union negotiating committee for the symphony. Mm-hmm. He has just tremendous powers of persuasion, and he really had a very his tenure was very healing, and things really did start to go very right under his administration.
Now, was he here at the time of the affiliation?
Yes, he was on the faculty.
But he wasn't director at
the... No. Uh-huh. He was appointed acting dean. To replace Irving Lowens, and he was a wonderful choice because he is, you know, he was a person of great integrity. I mean, certainly no one could fault his stature as a musician. I mean, he was a respected member of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra for many years, a fine teacher. My goodness, a number of his students are, you know, have wonderful careers, and I mean not one, but a number of them, and you know, and a man who enjoyed the respect of his colleagues. So I mean, he was absolutely the right person to step in as first acting director and then director of the institution. And Bob Sirota was a brilliant choice as a successor. He's a real visionary, and a phenomenally bright man. You know, he's always two jumps ahead of everybody else, and it's interesting. He's a composer. You know, most of our directors have been, or many of our directors have been composers. You know, Deems, Southard, Hamrick, coming right up. Harold Randolph was a pianist. Peabody educated, first American-born and trained pianist to achieve a first-rate career.
Who's that?
Harold Randolph. Mm-hmm. It was under Harold Randolph that the preparatory department was brought into the Peabody. The department was headed up by May Garretson Evans, who had tried to interest Hamrick in taking it on. Hamrick thought it was a great idea, but never got around to bringing it into the under the aegis of the conservatory. So May Garretson Evans just went off and established it herself. And
tell me about the prep. That's one of the things I have on my list to talk about.
Well, she was a Peabody trained musician. She was a newspaper reporter for the Sun, and and a rare flower indeed during those days. And she went down to apply for the job as, you know, like music and theater critic, which her brother had, and he had been had gone on to another post. And the editor asked her, why she thought she could do this job, and she said, "Well, actually, I've been writing a lot of my brother's reviews when he didn't have time to go to this concert or that event," and pointed out which ones she'd actually written, and they were pretty good. And so she got the job.
That's great.
And she was actually beating the bushes for a news story, and there wasn't a thing happening, and so she decided to go up and interview Asger Hamrick. And she said, you know, there's always been this problem of musicians coming into the conservatory with inadequate training. You know, don't you think it would be a really good idea for Peabody to run a preparatory department where they could get first-rate training by Peabody-trained faculty, and they wouldn't have to go through this agonizing process of relearning how to play and da-da-da-da. And he said, "Yeah, that's a very good idea." So she went back and wrote this big story about how Asger Hamrick was contemplating the institution of a preparatory department at Peabody. And she kept after him about it, and it just never happened. So finally, she just went ahead and did it herself, rounded up a bunch of her friends, including Harold Randolph's wife, and who would become the next director, and rented 17 East, I think it was 17 East Mount Vernon, Center Street. And she figured they'd use the first floor and they'd rent the rooms above, which would pay for the building. And she put a big ad in the Sun paper, and she not only had enough students to fill her projected list, but ended up having to use every square inch of the building for music lessons. I mean, she had a tremendous enrollment. She had several hundred students all of a sudden. And the place just went like gangbusters. And so when Hamrick left, he was replaced by Harold Randolph. Randolph was very much interested in the education of musicians and bothered very much by the fact that, you know, if you're good, you perform and you have a career. If you're not so good, you teach. And this was something that really bothered him. I mean, that's not to say that even then, all the people who taught were second-rate musicians, but there were, in fact, a lot of second-rate musicians who were teaching who hadn't really been trained to teach. And he thought that it would be a very interesting idea to start a program geared specifically to training teachers. And so they started the teacher training program, which was a very new thing at the conservatory, in a conservatory. And the idea of having this preparatory attached was perfect because it would provide a laboratory where these young teachers could teach and be supervised, and there would also be master teachers on the faculty, you know, who would be an example, who the younger teachers could go to for advice. And so it was Randolph who brought the preparatory, or May Garretson Evans Peabody Graduate School, which is what she called it because the faculty were all graduates of the Peabody, and brought that into the conservatory. So the preparatory was brought into the Conservatory of Music as a subsidiary of the conservatory, and to educate young musicians, to give them good, solid, early training, and also to provide a place where young teachers could get experience, you know, good first-hand experience in a supervised situation.
Great.
And it soon became the biggest institution of its kind in the country.
Really?
And May started settlement schools in poor areas of town. And it was the first institution of its kind to teach Native American dance. Toward the end of her tenure, May Garretson Evans and her younger sister Bessie and her sister Marion took themselves out west to an Indian reservation and did some of the earliest studies of Native American dance. And they presented the fruit of their work to at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and at the Peabody Museum at Yale. And Bessie and May published a book on Native American dance, showing the dance steps, which was so well done that recently our director of the preparatory department wanted to have some of the students perform these dances. And I had just come from working with my colleagues at the Peabody Museum and at Harvard, and I knew that there are a lot of sensitive areas there. I mean, this is not an area I knew a lot about, but I knew that this is an area that you really needed to ask somebody about before you did it. And so I said, you know, before you do this, it would be a good idea to contact the curatorial person at the Peabody Museum at Harvard to let them know what you're doing. And so they sent the diagram of the dance steps up that they wanted done. And they got a frantic call saying, you can't do this. This is a very serious, very sacred dance that white people aren't supposed to know about. But May had apparently made such an impression on these teachers that they taught her all of these secret dances, these very sacred works. And Bessie went home with May and wrote them up and published them. So this book is is a very important thing. And they said that she had done a phenomenal job.
Wow.
And the illustrations in the book were actually done by a Native American illustrator. They're quite handsome. They're very beautiful.
Huh. That's an interesting story.
But isn't that amazing?
You may have stopped a major scandal there, Elizabeth.
Well, I mean, it's just they wanted to be very respectful of this genre, and they wanted to make sure they weren't going to offend anyone, and it was a good thing we checked.
I think so. Do you think you can say that, and in many ways you've already answered this question, but succinctly, do you think you can say that the Peabody has a personality?
Yeah, I think so. Years ago, there was a magazine called Dwight's Journal, and it was like Musical America today, and it was the leading voice in national voice, is, you know, in a periodical. And Dwight's predicted that Peabody would probably more than fulfill its destiny if it provided a decent place where young musicians could get a decent traditional education. And I don't know whether Asger Hamrick read that. I'm sure he probably did. But the people who have governed Peabody from early on have had a just different take on things. You know, it's always been, even from Hamrick's days, a place where the traditions of music are respected and honored and perpetuated, but it's also, you know, a place that's very much oriented toward tomorrow. It's an institution whose business is the future. I mean, that's why you train young musicians. And it's always been a place where you could try out new ideas and look at new ways of doing things and to hear new voices and I really think that's been its strength over the years. We were the first conservatory to have an electronic music studio. This was in the 1965-1966 season. I was here when they brought the first synthesizer in the door at Peabody. And, you know, my interest was early music. I mean, I had no interest in contemporary music when I came here. But I got caught up in performing contemporary music because it was so exciting, and there was so much going on here. And it wasn't happening at Juilliard. It wasn't happening at Curtis. It wasn't happening at New England. You know, it was happening here in this conservatory that was limping on from year to year, wondering whether there was enough money to pay the faculty. And it's just an amazing place. I mean, it's a place where, you know, somebody could decide, gosh, we should teach Native American dance. And so they did, and did it in a very serious way. It's wonderful to, you know, to respect the past. It's wonderful to, you know, to keep those traditions and honor those traditions. But it's really great to, you know, to have your eye on the horizon. And Peabody's been very fortunate in having people guide this institution who kept their eye on that horizon.
Well, you've answered my next question in answering that, as well as the one I asked you, so you're doing a great job, Elizabeth. What haven't I asked you? What should we be talking about that we haven't?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we've talked about so many things. We've talked just about a few of the students who have come out of here. One of the things that I guess we haven't talked about is how so many people from Peabody have insinuated themselves into the fabric of our lives locally. You know, it's hardly possible to visit a school, a church, a synagogue that doesn't have a Peabody musician in it, or several Peabody musicians. music education program at Peabody that Harold Randolph started all those years ago after the turn of the century has just turned out generations of really fine teachers. There's a member of our faculty who started studying in Cherry Hill as a Baltimore school child and was taught by one of the young women who was educated in the music education department, Shizona Thornton, who's a wonderful musician, and Gary Thomas, who's the head of the jazz department, studied with Shizona Thornton. You can drive up Charles Street and tick off the organists and choir directors and church musicians who graduated from Peabody or who attended Peabody, who are currently on the Peabody faculty. It's hard to go to a symphony concert, at Kennedy Center with visiting orchestras without running into Peabody people sitting in the chairs. And, Atlanta National Symphony, New York Philharmonic, Boston, Berlin. they're just everywhere. And obviously, somebody's been doing something right for a very long time here.
Obviously. Elizabeth, we're at the end of the tape. I can put in another one, but I sure have what I want here.
Well, good. I don't know.
You probably have other work to do. Thank you so very much.